Speaking of Reliability, a podcast with good friends talking with you about reliability engineering topics. Let's discuss how to create and improve your reliability program and your career.
Welcome to Speaking of Reliability. This is Fred Schenkelberg, and Kirk Gray is with us again today.
Hey, Fred.
No, we've talked about all kinds of different things, but I think you mentioned as we're getting started today that you'd ran across an article that seemed to find, you shared it on LinkedIn and it got a ton of different views and comments and stuff like that. And we've 3, talked 000. About this 3,000. That's awesome. But, you know, this is a topic that we've talked about before is right. This military contracting and maintenance and all this other good stuff. But when should, you know, tell me what, or tell the audience what you told me about this article, the gist of this thing.
I've posted it. I certainly encourage anybody to come to link in with anybody that's involved in reliability or the field of reliability. But I did put a post because there was an article in Business Insider, .com the title of the article was the F-35's reliability issues could push its total cost over $1.2 trillion. And my comment when I posted that link or that article was that once a test engineer working for a large DoD contractor told me at a reliability conference, and I think it was the ASTR, which I was the chairman, our general chair that year, he quote said to me, "These new reliability development techniques of halt and halves would be a lot easier to implement if spare parts and service did not constitute 60% of the total program profits." So he was telling me basically that they have a disincentive to make a very reliable. And I thought one of the comments in the People's Rely, I thought they were really interesting because we got 14 comments on it. But one of the main, I thought the first comments was, I heard something similar from a company president once, make it reliable, not too reliable.
That's right.
And I've brought the example that one of my recent consulting opportunities was ended because they were afraid I was going to try and make it reliable and that they wouldn't be able to provide. They had their culture of their company had been oriented to making much of their program profits off the spare parts and service. Mm-hmm. So they were really, it was a business concern of theirs that the product would be so reliable that they couldn't sell a bunch of spare parts. And I just thought that was, I don't want to participate in that kind of environment that, well, make it so it's kind of could break occasionally because we need, I can't do that.
Now the F-35, I've never been to the Paris Air Show, but you know, there's all kinds of aircraft and systems and that's a big wheeling right. and dealing trade show basically. Mm-hmm. You know, the F-35 is supposed to be, although I think they've been working on it for over 20 years, so I don't know how state-of-the-art it is at this point. But, it was, you know, it's going to be the cutting edge, pushing the right. envelope of functionality, all these wonderful features. It's a feature-driven platform, right? Mm-hmm. And even in, like here in Silicon Valley, when a product is feature driven, it's innovations and inventions and pushing the edge of stuff, reliability isn't the most important thing. But here in Silicon Valley, there's competition, right? It might, if you get great functionality out there, but it doesn't work, I'll give up functionality to get something that works.
Fred, right? you just mentioned the key word competition.
Well, there's other companies that can make fighter jets. It's, you know.
After about 5 years develop, well, look at, you just mentioned how long this F-35 Joint Strike Fighter has been in production, in development.
Development, yeah.
Yeah, and it's you know, the amount of clearances and all kinds of, I mean, it's all, of course, very high security clearances and,
well, all
and
the very details difficult
to change are very, very much so. So but you remember, can't just pick the plans.
Though, that when you remember, though, when these military air platforms are you know, started, Lockheed Martin, mm-hmm. McDonnell Douglas mm-hmm. and Boeing and everybody right. else is bidding on it.
Sure.
Right? And it's lowest bidder with the functionality and mm-hmm. which congressional district you're in. I think it matters.
Right.
You know?
Yes, and, very much so.
Right. But then once they get locked in, they got it for 20 years. And then they exactly. got it for the 20-year support after that.
Right. Right.
Yeah. You know?
Right. And it's very profitable to, you know, I mean, once you've got them locked in, then they don't really have an alternative supplier of the parts necessary.
Well, but why can't, you know, if the F-35 is so bad, as a military commander, I'd say, well, I don't want more of those. I want the F-16, which still works. Just give me more of them.
Right. Right?
And,
right.
And they'll go, they'll do the job for me.
Right. But
it's at least in our military system, and I'm sure it's reflected in other government agencies and other types of circumstances, and even within companies is, you know, it's the way we do budgeting, the way we do approvals, the way we create contracts mm-hmm. Have unintended consequences. And I think mm-hmm. the big one, like with the F-35, is mm-hmm. there's been such an emphasis on, well, where's it going to be built? What district is it in? All of the right. politics
right.
of,
and then sure.
the military sure. saying, well, I want it to go faster. I want it to go higher. I want it to do right. this. And right. all these, I want to cram 8 million features in the space that only one existed before. And it's a challenge, right?
And you also brought up a point that it took 35, you know, it's taking a long time to develop. Well, along that development line, new technologies are coming into play and things that are, you know, didn't exist when that program started now mm-hmm. would be even more you know, provide more capability to the pilot and things like that. And so, you know, you want to, you know, we've been going 10 years now and let's add this thing. And, you know, you can't really freeze a design that is,
well, they
is
never will.
It never will. So.
Oh, no. The B-52 is still getting upgrades, right? They're not using the same nav system they did back in the 50s.
Right.
So it's, I think that's all part of the process. Now, the other argument here, Kirk, is that if the government's spending $1.2 trillion to maintain this fleet of aircraft, mm-hmm. isn't that good for the economy? Isn't it? Well, wait a sec. That's our money.
It's only taxpayers. And we're only like 14, maybe it's $16 trillion in debt right now. I don't know where it's going to be real money, but I know the United States has a real serious budgeting problem. But just one of the things that this article says, and I'll quote, the assessment states that the supply chain for spare parts hasn't kept up with demand. Now, that first tells you, why is there such a demand for spare parts?
Well, it's part they used MTBF, I'm sure, yeah, to do their spares sure calculations.
They did lots of calculations. And that the parts have proven less reliable than expected. As a result, up to 20% of the jets must sit vacant, awaiting spares, hobbling the ability of squadrons to train in the jets. Over the lifetime of the F-35, buying, developing, maintaining decades could cause the U.S. upwards of $1.2 trillion, according to the assessment. So, yeah, I mean, you do have aircraft that are reliable, and those are the ones that are using commercial aircraft because that is, in fact, Southwest Airlines, Delta, all the airlines that are competitive. It's very costly for them to have an aircraft down.
Oh, yeah.
So, in fact, I think that, you know, that is a world of competition. That is a true commercial market. Airbus, Boeing, I guess McDonnell Douglas is gone. It's part of Boeing.
It's Embraer and is a Brazilian aircraft company.
Yeah, there's a Brazilian
aircraft
company.
Canadian company that's doing right. some great stuff. Right. I like the Canadian ones. And
I've flown in those, and they're great. They're for small jets usually. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. But you know, I mean, look at the Southwest, how many 737s they have, and they mm-hmm. are sticking with that. They're not going to go to any of these, you know, they don't have any need to, but that's their whole business
model. What their model was is just use this one model, this one version. We have one right. set of power plants on them. We have one set of spares. We only need to train our technicians on one aircraft.
Right. You know, we have a volume buying of spare parts. You know, we only buy for 737s. Mm-hmm. So they have a real commonality and things like that. They don't have Airbuses in their fleet, I don't think.
Nope, I think it's all 37s.
And so that's, yeah, I agree with you that the you know, buying an older model, maybe that's reliable, can be more cost effective than having all these bells and whistles on a new model that doesn't.
Well, let's take it to a more personal level. When we go buy a car, right? I'm kind of annoying back to the dealership. Is I say I want to go talk to the maintenance guys. I want to go talk to the maintenance bay, and yeah. they don't want me to go in there. And I peek into it. And I say, how many? You know, if I want a Toyota Highlander and I go to the Toyota dealer and I look down the bay and they have 20 bays, and if 15 of them are Highlanders, I'm going to ask a lot of questions. But
right.
when I did that, there weren't any Highlanders in there, even for oil changes in that particular day. So they kind of got mm-hmm. lucky. I says, well, all right, I want to talk to one of your maintenance guys. How do these things fail? What's the most likely thing to fail? And they're like, oh, they never fail. Well, you just do maintenance on it. I said, no, you know exactly how they fail. They come in here and they have transmission issues. They have navigation dashboard issues. They have your seat doesn't work. What are the top 10 things you've seen in the last month on this model of car? Mm-hmm. And just push and push and push. And I said, you know, if you don't tell me, I'm not buying it. Because mm-hmm. If you don't know what the issues are, what do I need to be watching for and looking for? And then mm-hmm. I turn to the sales guy and I says, all right, we have three cars out here that all are in the model and style I like. Which one's not going to have those problems? And he's just like, oh, I don't know. Well, what care, you know, because I'm looking at what's the cost of maintaining this. If my car goes down, I can't get to a client. I can't get to the airport. Right, I have to pay Uber or pay for, you know, an alternate vehicle to do it.
Yeah.
It costs me money when things go down. Now, it's not $1.2 trillion by any means, mm-hmm. but it's real money to me. So it's...
No, I agree. And that's, you know, and in fact, the warranties on cars has kind of reflected a lot of the improvement in automobiles, too. But I rely on, I'm a member of Consumers Union and rely on Consumer Reports since they have no advertising allowed. And mm-hmm. they do a pretty good job of evaluating things. I think they may miss some things, but they really do. And they do a survey every year of people's reliability of the cars. And, you know, it's been reported, of course, that Toyota has and Lexus, their high-end line, are some of the most reliable cars. Mm-hmm. And so, but I use that as a guide on what I buy. I look at their, you know, best used cars for the money, and they have a long history over many decades of assessing mm-hmm. car reliability. So that's the one guide I can use, I think. To other than that, my experience. Personal experience, I think that's probably true with you. If you bought a Toyota and it lasted forever, you know, mm-hmm. until you tend to want to go buy another one. You know, you like their capability and you're kind of familiar with their.
Well, they're, you know, layout. We're going to get a little off field here because I took my car in for just its, I don't know, 50,000 mile service or whatever. And they made an appointment. They said, be here at 8 o'clock. And I'm like, great. And I got there about 10 to 8. And there were 180 cars lined up.
Uh-oh.
They all had an 8 o'clock appointment. It took 2 hours for them to actually put my car in, you know, take it into service. I was livid. I was posting on Yelp. Yeah. I gave him a horrible review.
Absolutely.
If you're giving me a, you know, it's nothing to do with the reliability of it, but man, that was not, it's convenient for you to batch all your cars and get them all queued up for the day. Nah, if you give me an appointment, I want an appointment. That's when I'm going to be taken care of.
Right.
And I was like, oh, man. So
reliable appointments are important.
You know,
and not just giving you a time, but actually acting on that time. You know, yeah, that's true. A little off base, but is it reliable that you, when you come to a dealership, you, or you come to a dentist or a doctor, you know, you're going to be seen.
Funny, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So,
and so part of their cost, and it's the same thing with the F-35 though, is they're saying, well, you want all this stuff, right? And here's what we're proposing. We can design, and here's the technology we can do and so on. Oh, and by the way, you want it to last a while. Now, whose fault is that? I mean, if the contracting up front squeezes every penny out of it, so it's mm-hmm. it's a cost plus design process. So mm-hmm. they don't make any money on it. And the way the contracts are is they don't, so when Boeing sells an aircraft to Southwest, I'm quite sure the failure rate of that aircraft, the downtime of that aircraft, is built into the contract. If that's a lemon aircraft, Boeing's going to have to pay for it, right?
Right.
Whereas if you get a lemon F-35, that's probably not in the contract. That the if the whoever's making the F-35, I don't know if it's Boeing or somebody else, but if they had to pay for any maintenance over $2 billion, I bet you it would not have a problem with spares or the cost of the parts.
Right.
You know? So I think there's some fundamental disincentives in that whole system, but it also speaks to that reliability was not, and its maintenance trail was, even though everybody knows that that's an expensive part of the system, they're just saying, but that's not what we're working on. You know, we're not worried about that part. They'll pay for that later.
Right. Right. Exactly. It was get it to work, just work. And then we'll have this, what's called reliability growth process, which I always thought was interesting because I've been in the commercial world and you do reliability.
That. Yeah, you do that in design.
Exactly. That's what you're doing in testing your growth. But unfortunately, they go back and they can get the military to help pay for improving the design, which is, you know, again, another group of a lot of money. So so it goes on, but it's a culture. It's a culture.
I think it's more than a culture. I think it's because they use MTBF. Well, it's just it's another reason MTBF is bad. Is that the
Well, that's funny you say that because I think the same guy or one of those guys in that same conference said, you know, without Mil Handbook 217 and MTBF, I wouldn't have a job. He says that's, you know, that's what
that's
I do.
That's what he does.
Oh, he does predictions.
That's so sad.
I know it is sad because it's our money. It's taxpayer dollars. And even the and I've, you know, put in my book and also published on my website, acceleratedreliabilitysolutions.com. If you want to go there, you'll find the article that says reliability prediction, a continued reliance on a misleading approach, written by two U.S. Army supply. I guess it's a material analyst, analyst, and a professor at the University of Maryland. Yep. So they really have, you know, again, this thing that's been going on for decades, they've really are pointing out directly why prediction misleads the designers, misleads the program, and why it's very costly. And so, again, you just mentioned in our last podcast how the CREs dropped testing. I think, you know, in my world and my perspective, we need to do more testing, and we need to do testing to the absolute limits of the capability of the products and find the strength of the products. And that's how we do comparative analysis of the next generation. And
you know, that might be a subject for another discussion, though, Kirk, is that the CRE is – it really reduced the number of tests they mention. They reduce the emphasis on testing, the importance of it in the overall quality knowledge has got reduced.
Right.
It's something else I've seen in quality is just moving away from test. You can't test in quality.
No, you can't test in quality.
But and I think – but what I see it with clients I'm working with is that they don't have budget or time or interest in doing testing. And there is more and more simulation capability and CAD systems and in SPICE models and so on.
And some of those make sense and some of those are valid. Okay. I'm not going to blink at everything, but some of them are. Yeah.
But I think there's more and more moving away from test. And if I create an F-35, I can test the landing gear, right? I can create a rig for that. And I can test it. I can test wings. I can test materials.
Right. Mechanical systems.
And I can test electronics. I can test all kinds of stuff separately.
Right.
You put them all together in this massive vibration shaker with a heat source in the middle of it. The system is very expensive to test, you know?
Yes.
And they unfortunately, they built the first prototypes and it took them a while to get one to work. they learned a lot and I'm sure they made improvements and so on, but it's an incredibly complex machine.
Absolutely.
But I think there's plenty of things that we do in the commercial world and competition's a piece of it. We started off with that. is just missing. So if the military said, all right, Boeing and Lockheed Martin, you both create a design and get it all the way through the system, the one that will have the lowest total cost for ownership, right, you know, purchase and maintenance wins.
Right.
And then put in the contract that if it costs more than $2 to maintain this thing for a week, you pay for it.
Right. That would be a radical change in the contracting culture.
That's right.
The way they're doing it. So those are kind of dreams that I don't think will be realized. Just like I think, you know, again, 80% of a reliability program should be focused on testing and finding limits and finding weaknesses. And at different levels, you're right, comprehensive, you know, doing the whole system may be expensive. Some systems you don't need to do because they've been established as really reliable in the field. Maybe there's all kinds of, you know, things that you can do. But again, comprehensive system level testing, more than just one component, has a much bigger efficiency, I think, than the individual content. You know, all of those things cost, but so the best is to get the biggest bang out of the buck of testing, and that's where I feel halt. And later, it has, if necessary, and it really shouldn't be necessary for longer than just the learning curve, the initial production. Those are the ways to be efficient in developing a product. And those that companies that, you know, like Apple and Hewlett Packard and everybody, for the most part, I think, is in the commercial world is doing some kind of form of halt, probably, may not be taking it to what I consider the ultimate capability. But that everybody's starting to learn, and I, you know, it's pretty established. You use halt in almost, or say, mention halt in almost every podcast I listen to, not including me, you know, not my podcast.
Well, I'm just talking about guys. You then, Kirk. Yeah.
But I know you like it, and you realize the benefit of going to find weaknesses and limits. And that's what frustrates us, is a lot of people are use one sample. You know, we talked about it earlier. They say, oh, can't you just do it with one sample? No, this is important enough. And when we find something, we may need some more samples to assess how that weakness is manifests itself and, and, you know, how weak it is. So those are kind of things. But I hope that I don't think we're going to change the contracting of the.
Well, you should run for Congress in Colorado. I'll get on it from California. It made me think, because I wonder how many reliability professionals are in Congress. If that would, I don't know that it would make any difference. There's medical doctors there, and we've screwed up our healthcare pretty bad. So
right, I'm sure there's got to be a few engineers. I know there's a few doctors and things like that.
Yeah, I don't know. You think engineers would get into politics? I thought we're smarter than that.
Yeah, probably, and not too extrovert. Most engineers are not very extroverted. I think
we'll have to do a quick check and find our reliability champion in politics, and
that'd be great.
See if we can get him on the show. Yeah. Well, we'll find out. Yeah. So if you know of anybody that's in Congress that's a reliability-minded person, we'd love to know who that is.
Boy, it would be great to talk to him on a podcast, wouldn't it?
Oh, it would be. Yeah. Well, let's wrap this one up here. So for listeners, if you've got a solution for the F-35 exorbitant maintenance costs, you know, contact your local military outlet. Good luck with that.
Yeah, good luck.
But it's real money. And it's the classic, you know, where if you're not paying attention to the cost of maintenance and cost of ownership for a repairable system, it will come back to you and it will cost you money. Where factories and even my car, I care about that kind of stuff. And we minimize it. And it can be done. It certainly can be done.
Now, yes.
So let us know what you think. Look for Kirk's article up on LinkedIn. We also hopefully will get you to do a summary of this and post the article or link to the article up on Ascendo under your series there. That'd be good. We could link to that.
Okay.
But let us know what your thoughts are. You know, what you can do a rant if you want on the military procurement process, but more so, what is it we can do as reliability professionals in our own world to help minimize the cost of ownership, the cost of maintenance going forward? And there's a lot of good practices out there. Let's share those and let's talk about those. But head over to reliability.fm. You can find this show and four other podcasts that are all focused on reliability in one form or another, and plenty of ways you can get in touch with us. It certainly makes our day when we hear from you. So please do that. So Kirk, yeah. Appreciate the time and bringing up this article. I think it's, okay. It's great. You got a lot of exposure to it and a lot of comments. And I think there's needs to be a lot more discussion on it. So I thanks for encouraging that.
I think there is too. It was a big interest, and it actually is a Bloomberg article, and I'll put a link at the show notes to the actual full article that they talk about. So yeah, it's great to talk to you again, Fred. Always love talking about reliability and the challenges of that whole field. Our field is particularly challenging because of the long time frame that it takes to realize you're unreliable.
That's right. All right. Well, we'll wrap it up there. Thanks, Kirk. Talk to you later.
Okay, Fred. Talk to you later. Bye.
Bye.
Thanks for listening to Speaking of Reliability. We invite you to join the conversation. If you have a question or a topic that you think we should discuss in a future show, please let us know. You can find a comment box below the episode show notes, or just leave a note as part of a review on iTunes.